Welcome to the PeaceWorks Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Moles. I'm a pastor and biblical counselor who helps churches and families confront the evil of domestic violence and promote healthy, God-honoring relationships. And welcome back to the PeaceWorks Podcast, everyone. On today's episode, we're going to be answering your questions about revictimization. But before we jump into that topic, I want to remind you of the resources that are available to you at chrismoles.org, in particular, PeaceWorks University. Week after week, I come back and remind you that PeaceWorks University is your best next step. If you're benefiting from the content that we deliver here on the podcast, well, you're going to find much more at PeaceWorks University. We have our content organized. We have discussions with experts in the field, success paths to help you develop your response, homework and toolbox items that can be used in developing cases. And I think you're going to find PeaceWorks University to be a tremendous resource. You can learn more about that at chrismoles.org. All right, on today's episode, we are talking about revictimization. It's a term that has been used for many, many years. And like any term, any aspect of language, it has somewhat evolved. Sometimes it finds different meanings in different places. And so I'm going to give a little bit of my opinion based on how I was trained and equipped and some of the observations I have. But let's go directly to the question, because there's a couple parts and I would like to cover as much as possible in our time together. The question goes, there are many ways in which the church or people helpers mismanage a case in ways that it can harm people, but could you please specifically address ways it harms victims and what is meant by the term revictimization, and is it the same as secondary abuse? A lengthy question, but a few parts. One, the end of the question, what is revictimization and is it the same as secondary abuse? Another aspect is, in what ways does mismanagement harm the victim? So let's just start with the terminology. Really what we're doing with terms like secondary abuse or revictimization is we are attempting to explain the harm that is occurring in our response. So as we're responding to disclosures of abuse, as we're responding and working and interacting with cases of abuse, we're attempting to explain the harm that individuals, victims in particular, are currently experiencing. And like any term, the language has changed over time. Let me try to unpack that before I jump specifically into the term. So some of you have heard me talk about this in abuse work sometimes, especially since the internet. Absolutely, especially since information, spreads so quickly now through the internet. Some of the terminology that we kind of agreed upon has somewhat been nuanced and retooled to help speak to specific cases or specific aspects of abuse. Let me try to unpack that even more. One good example of that is just the overarching term of abuse. So abuse is the constructed terminology that we use in English to help us understand, generally speaking, that use of power to dominate or control. We understand that abuse is this aspect of power over, all right? But within that, to kind of help us understand the experience of victims, we have over time developed separate categories to help us understand, such as emotional abuse, psychological abuse, economic abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, obviously. However, those categories are not necessarily separate. They are all interconnected. For instance, a victim of sexual abuse, we would not then say automatically, well, they were a victim of sexual abuse, but not necessarily emotional abuse. Like, we understand that the categories are not separate entities. They are simply helping us understand the specific impact of the larger category. And so what has happened is over time, for instance, these categories have become their own thing, their own discipline, which is understandable because a lot of people are experiencing emotional abuse that may not be experiencing direct physical abuse, although they are interconnected. Another example would be the clinical terminology that's kind of been, for lack of a better word, hijacked, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but clinical terminology like narcissism or narcissistic abuse, which is not really identified as a thing. I hate to put it that way. I wish I had a more technical term, but narcissistic abuse is not really identified clinically. And what has happened is the terminology has kind of been hijacked to describe the experience of certain folks. And unfortunately, the negative side of that is that there's kind of been an interpretation that if anyone's abusive, then they're therefore narcissistic or they're clinically diagnosable or what have you. Another example, theologically, in a very, very similar vein, has been the understanding of reprobate. So theologically speaking, the reprobate is the idea of somebody who has been hardened to such a degree that they are not capable or perhaps not able to repent, that there's just such a barrier to repentance. And there are some who theologically would say, hey, if you commit an act of abuse, if you're an abuser, then you're a reprobate, you're beyond redemption. And that blanket type of understanding of the language, I think, has harmed the cause of the gospel. Because quite frankly, most men in particular that I work with who commit acts of abuse would not theologically qualify as reprobates. Some would, in much the same way that my clinician friends would probably say some of the men that they work with would categorize that are abusive would fall in the category of narcissists, but not all of them. So language is really important, and I bring all that up to say I think that's happened somewhat with the term revictimization. And I think our questioner is kind of alluding to it because the questioner begins by connecting this experience to mismanagement, but then also wants to know if there's a distinguishing, if there's something distinguishing secondary abuse from revictimization. And I would say historically, yes, although more recently, the terms have kind of been used interchangeably. I myself have been guilty of this. It's just a little easier to use common vernacular. Let me try to unpack what I mean by that for those of you who are maybe getting lost. I'm getting lost a little bit, so let me slow down and go through those terms. Secondary abuse would be this idea. It's a category that describes the experience of a trauma survivor receiving counterproductive or negative assistance, sometimes neutral assistance, but let's really focus on the counterproductive or negative. They're seeking help, but in the process of seeking help, they're hurt. An individual, let's say, is a victim of sexual abuse. All right, let's use one of those categories I just talked about not using. But let's say they're a victim of sexual abuse, and with that comes trauma and emotional distress and mental distress and affects her whole being, right? And in the process of seeking help, she's taken to the hospital by law enforcement, and they conduct a rape kit. In the weeks following her encounter with law enforcement, her encounter with the hospital, her encounter with the courts, her tests have never been observed or sent to the lab. They've been lost in the bureaucracy, excuse me. Law enforcement has moved on to other cases. The prosecutor can't find enough evidence to support her. And the entire time, she's been begging and pleading for help. The neglect, misunderstandings, mismanagement, and minimization have contributed to a greater degree negatively to her experience of sexual abuse. I hope this is making sense. Historically, we would call that secondary abuse. Individuals in power, folks who are supposed to be helping, people who have authority through either ignorance or overwhelm or mismanagement, have not been able to serve her well and in fact have served her poorly. So the abuse that she experienced is compounded by secondary acts of harm by those who are supposed to be helping. Now, interestingly enough, you'll more than likely hear this term now, meaning something a little different. Like now you'll hear folks talk about secondary abuse almost like we used to talk about revictimization. They've kind of been swapped in some circles, but I guess I'll come back to that in a moment. Let me talk about revictimization. So historically, secondary abuse was the idea of a trauma survivor, a victim, being assisted poorly, negatively, or counterproductively so that the desired help had a negative impact, a secondary abuse through neglect, mismanagement, misunderstanding, etc., which contributes to not trusting authority, not seeking help from those who are supposed to be helping, or recognizing that the help is actually more harm. So secondary abuse. Revictimization has historically been the experiencing of abuse again. So it's the re in victimization is the idea of it's happened again. So it can be a repeat of the abusive act. So an individual who has been re-victimized, let's stay with the sexual abuse theme. So an individual is sexually abused, and then they're sexually abused again and again. Each act is a re-victimization, right? A recurring act of harm. It can also be similar. An individual experiences abuse as a child and finds themselves in a relationship as an adult where those childhood traumas and harms are revisited by a partner, right? So now I was sexually abused as a child, and now I'm being sexually abused as an adult. I'm being sexually abused in my marriage. There's a re-victimization. I'm coming back to this place of similar harm, either from the same perpetrator or a new perpetrator. It can also refer to being a victim of a cover-up. So this would fall into the category of church as well, saying with the sexual abuse theme, an individual is sexually abused by their youth pastor, and the church fails to decides not to report the incident to law enforcement, aids in the removal of the youth pastor, but finding him another job in another state, essentially covering up his act of abuse. That is a re-victimization as the church, person in power, is deliberately harming the victim again. And so a victim of a cover-up, a victim of slander, a victim of a ruined reputation, a victim of the machinery of the institution, that would all fall in that category of re-victimization. And so, again, from my perspective, secondary abuse is that layered trauma of mismanagement, neglect, minimization, and misunderstanding, whereas revictimization is the deliberate and intentional use of harm, coercion, and control on a victim, either by the same perpetrator in the same manner, a new perpetrator in the same manner, or in a similar manner to cover up slander or ruin the reputation of a victim, re-victimizing them again and again and again. Now, in more recent days, and I'm not necessarily opposed to this, I'm just saying that this is how language evolves over time, and it does make our work difficult when so many voices are talking about so many things. We welcome multiple voices, but sometimes the language shifts and changes, and we need to have these discussions. Now, oftentimes, revictimization is, I think, reduced. And I don't mean this in a negative way. I just mean it in a, I think we need to be more thoughtful, because I do think the term revictimization gets a little watered down when we only refer to the personal experience of an individual. I feel revictimized. That may be true. And so as a counselor or a clinician or a helper, I want to walk through that, but it may not be the same, right, as an individual who was harmed and then harmed and then harmed again in order to preserve some kind of status. It may be an individual who was harmed and then is having difficulty in life responding to triggers and temptations and enticements related to that harm. And so I do think sometimes revictimization has been a term that we now use sometimes to talk about individuals who are attempting to navigate life after a great harm. And certainly when you experience a great harm, a great wickedness in your life, it's going to be difficult to have relationships. And those relationships are going to come with pain and confusion and trouble. And I think sometimes when we use the word revictimization to describe that pain, it's not necessarily doing us a great service for victims, especially who are being re-harmed to the same degree or similar degree. But I'm not going to split hairs over that, because we're really asking clinicians and helpers and pastors and church leaders to help people, right? Not necessarily nuance the terms in the counseling room. So if somebody says, you know, I feel re-victimized, then let's process that. Let's pull the rope. Let's gather the information and process, what are you experiencing? Is it further harm at the hands of your perpetrator? Because that requires a different response than is it difficulty in navigating life post-abuse? Both of those need specific help, but not the same response. I hope that's a fair assessment of our response and our need to be compassionate as we interact with these terms and as we interact with individuals who are trying, and we should be helping them try successfully to manage and process their experiences. Well, the other part of the question, not just is there a difference between re-victimization and secondary abuse? And again, I would say that there is, although I don't want to split hairs too much about using those as descriptors, because we want to hear what our counselees and clients are saying and then step into that world and help them process it biblically. However, the context of the question was about mismanagement and the ways in which mismanagement harm victims. And so let's just take kind of the examples I used and broaden them out from those two categories of secondary abuse and revictimization. Certainly, when a church covers up abuse, they are complicit in the wickedness of the perpetrator. Some will find that very hard to hear and maybe consider it a little too harsh. However, if there's clear evidence and that this individual has harmed another, that this pastor or elder or leader or person has significantly harmed a member of the congregation in an abusive way, whether it be domestic abuse, sexual abuse, or so on, the church is obligated to respond appropriately through proper discipline and, when required, right, reporting offenses that fall within that purview, right? So responding well. When we choose not to responding, if we choose not to respond well, when we choose instead to cover up, we are participating in the wickedness. So I think churches have to be not only warned, I guess churches have to be not only educated, but warned at the demonic, and I think that's a strong enough word, demonic and wicked wickedness of cover-ups and participating in slander. And so at that level, I think we need to be very, very clear. The questioner is talking more about mismanagement, misunderstandings, ignorance, responding without training. A lot of harm can be done as well to victims of abuse when helpers mismanage. And that harm can include delayed healing and success. So it actually delays the effective function of the individual who's seeking help. And so the victim is going to be prolonged in their process. It's going to often delay or eliminate consequences, which are a healthy and necessary part of the perpetrator's confrontation. It is often going to shoot at the wrong target, meaning it's going to assign guilt in the wrong places and assign blame in the wrong places and therefore call for responsibility from the wrong individuals. So that mismanagement puts extra weight on the victim and often softens the load carried by the perpetrator. Mismanagement of cases can also actually be self-fulfilling prophecies. And what I mean by that is often churches engage in poor solutions to abuse out of fear of divorce, that they want to preserve the marriage. But in doing so, in making the marriage a priority, and in many ways reinforcing and establishing the abuse as a part of that relationship, they're simply preparing the way for divorce or something worse. It's going to be very difficult to sustain a marriage that is grounded in abuse. And when a church makes that their priority, they're almost giving a self-fulfilling prophecy. Well, God hates divorce, and so we're going to do everything we can to make this marriage so miserable that divorce or death is the only option. I know that's pretty graphic, but it's somewhat what we're doing. Reestablishing or establishing trauma bonds can be part of this, and that'd be something I'd love to have an expert on trauma talking about with us, as opposed to me just riffing about it. And then, of course, the effects it's going to have on children, the impact that it could have on relational dynamics, social dynamics, sexual dynamics in regards to kids are all part of that process, even when well-meaning folks handle situations poorly. So I won't go too much farther down the line on that because we're running short on time, but maybe we'll revisit this in the future. I hope there was some clarity today in our conversation that revictimization is real. Secondary abuse is something that individuals are experiencing. And we as helpers, if we're poorly trained, if we're functioning poorly, we're mismanaging cases, we can contribute to that. And certainly, if we as churches and leaders are deliberately functioning to cover up, slander, or isolate the abuse in such a way to protect the perpetrator, we're doing great damage to generations of people and to the name of Christ. I hope this was helpful today, guys. I will be back. We'll keep doing this. Thank you for being part of the Peaceworks podcast. We couldn't do it without you. Be sure to rate and review and let the platform you're listening on know that you appreciate the Peaceworks podcast. All right, until next time, God bless.